American reaction to these economic ties? Certainly, the United States will not be satisfied or pleased with these relations. But regardless of this, Iran has always succeeded in evading illegal American sanctions. Iran succeeded in delivering all derivatives to Syria and broke the equation of unilateral punitive measures by delivering aid to Venezuela and to Lebanon as well. We even witnessed the war that almost erupted in the Arabian Sea after the United States of America tried to block one of the ships transporting Iranian oil derivatives. And you know very well that today there are negotiations underway in Vienna. If the results of these talks are positive, it is a good thing. And if not, I think that there are escalatory steps that Iran will take to break the siege, and the financial and banking sector is not immune to these steps. I'm referring here specifically to the Syrian-Iranian joint bank, which will be activated soon.
Well, Masera, Minister Kazemi said something very interesting during his visit concerning transportation in various sectors being one of the most important requirements for both countries' economic development. So the road the U.S. waged war against Syria to prevent from opening between regional countries, especially Iran, Iraq, and Syria, will officially be opened soon. Some might say Syria paid a heavy price for this road. Do you agree?
Of course, Syria paid a heavy price for this road and this war in general. Syria, as you may know, was a strong country in West Asia. It has moved from being a country that is self-sufficient and food-sufficient with zero foreign debts to a country that, unfortunately, is experiencing suffocating economic and social crises. But for now, what is most important is that the blood of the martyrs should not be wasted, the blood of the martyrs who fell in this war. An important issue you touch upon is construction and infrastructure project that will link the three countries, Iran, Iraq, and Syria together. This project will bring about very important economic and political results for all three states and will provide jobs for many citizens. This project will not only transport goods between the three countries, but will also transport citizens. For instance, goods used to take 2 months to reach from Iran to Syria. Today, thanks to this project, if it is successfully implemented, goods will only take a few days to reach Syria. The project's starting point will be the Iranian-Iraqi border. It will stretch to reach Al-Qa'im, then to Al-Bukamal, and then to Homs, and to end off at two destinations, the Syrian capital Damascus and Latakia on the Syrian coast. Certainly, this project will have very important economic and political results. Also, this project will be linked to other networks in Central Asia, and in turn, these networks will be linked to other networks in Russia and China.
Well, Masera, exactly what you said is very important because officially Syria has joined China's Intercontinental Belt and Road Initiative, defying strict U.S. sanctions, which I don't like to call sanctions. They are unilateral punitive measures by the United States of America against Syria in hopes of securing a lifeline for lucrative investment in a country that is still ravaged by more than a decade of global war against it. Now, Damascus participation happened during the same week which it's actually signed the new deals with Iran. It did the signatory with the Chinese ambassador in Syria, Mr. Feng Biao, opening up to Iran and to China in the same week. Look, I can hear Americans screaming because of this, but how do you think this step will benefit Syria in the upcoming future?
Of course, the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, or the One Belt, One Road Initiative, is the largest initiative of the century. And since the planning of this initiative, Syria was destined to be an essential component of it, but the war effectively delayed its accession to this initiative. You also remember that the Chinese foreign minister was in Damascus in the seventh month of the last year, and he signed that at that time this agreement to return this year to the signing of a memorandum of understanding between the Syrian Planning and International Cooperation Authority and the Chinese side, authorizing Syria's entry into this initiative, which includes several economic and social aspects like health, education, and most important of all is the aspect of reconstruction. We may not see its results tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, but we will certainly see them soon. You know, the direction of the Syrian government today is to head east. Unfortunately, we have previously experienced failed projects with the European Union, which used our economy to blackmail us in politics and impose unjust unilateral sanctions. This is a fundamental reason for what we Syrians are experiencing today from several stifling living and economic crises. Meanwhile, China has proved in the past 10 years that it is an economic superpower that has been rising tremendously and has also proven that it is a trustworthy partner. I stress here on the word partner because it has established a new concept in international relations, which is partnership between great powers and other countries instead of the concept of hegemony.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Ms. Sarah Saloum, independent journalist and political commentator, for joining us from Damascus to talk about the recent economic ties between Iran, Syria, and China, for that matter. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream. Bye-bye.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani al-lain ar-rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin, bari'il khalaiq ajma'in, ba'athil anbiya'i wal mursalin, was salatu was salam ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina wa habibi qulubina wa tabib nufusina wa shafi' dhunubina. أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. One of the recommended acts or deeds, أعمال of this blessed month is استغفار. This is a month that we need to focus on this. We need to focus while we engage in this quarantine or whatever you want to name it, the conditions that we have because of COVID. Even with the vaccine, it's coming out, people are getting vaccinated, but it's not clear how that will change things. It probably won't change things for it may not change things for the time being. And we don't know when a cure that is viable, that will allow us to, that will help. Hopefully the vaccine will help. There'll be less deaths, less cases that we will lose people, but in terms of getting us back to where we can easily get together, congregate, not to have to wear masks, reduce numbers in gatherings and so on, God knows when that's going to happen. We know He's going to remove it. He has done this in the past, and He will do it in this case as well. But this is a blessing right now. This is the point. We don't know that. Take it as a blessing. It is a blessing. It is a blessing to have that extra time instead of allowing... Now, allowing our minds, usually they would wander off. We got so many things that keep us busy. Now, there's less of that. We get bored of everything because we're just on our devices and we can't get out as much. We can't go to places the same way. We can't see people in the same way. We have a lot more time on our hands that we can dedicate to looking within, finding and identifying those issues, those flaws, those problems. And inshallah, asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and trying our best, correcting those. And another thing that we mentioned this, I think a year ago when this thing hit first, this is an opportunity. We get a chance to be with those that we, because of our closeness to them, because we have spent so much time with them, our family members, our parents, our children, our siblings, our whoever it is that we live with, we're with all the time, and for so many years, we've gotten used to bad ways of dealing with each other, bad ways of thinking of each other. And we like to avoid that. We like to move away from each other. We like to spend time elsewhere. Now, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put us in a condition where we have to see each other. Well, this is a good opportunity. Let's try to correct those. Don't worry about others correcting it or not correcting it. This is about us. Looking within, me changing myself, let me change the way I think and deal with others. whether they want to change or not, that's their business. Instead of focusing on what their issues are, why did he say this? Why did she say that? What was she trying to do? What was he trying to do? Instead of that thought process, why did I say this? Why did I say that? Why was I trying to hurt this person's feeling? Why don't I realize that when I say this, when I do that, it irritates people? And I shouldn't be doing that. What's the point of me doing this? Why do I do this? Well, those should be our questions. Find these flaws. Use this opportunity of purification that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us. It's the month of Rajab. We can spend a lot of time in prayers. All these prayers, one of the things that came from the leader, may Allah protect him and give him a long life. It had developed into a practice that was an annual practice, the great teaching of i'tikaf in Islam, where you spend at least 3 days in a masjid, fasting the days, and during the day and the night engaging in worship, avoiding matters of the dunya, focusing on the hereafter, focusing on one's connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The month of Rajab, the days of the 13th, 14th, and 15th, became a tradition. Islam is not limited in that. The Prophet used to do it on the last 10 days of the month of Ramadan. These were 3 days because of the holidays, more people would be able to engage in that. And the least number of days is 3 days. So youth would get together in masajid in numbers, in plenty of masajid in the shrines of the Ahlul Bayt, the shrine of Imam al-Ridha, the shrine of the Lady Fatima al-Ma'suma, Salamullahi alayha in Qum, the shrines of the other children of the Ahlul Bayt, the other great figures, the masajid within them. People used to congregate in large numbers and be in that state of worship and dua and supplication. Because of Corona, again this year, they haven't been able to do that. So the leader said he encourages and he recommends those who would want to be involved in that and are not able to because of the conditions to do Salat Ja'far al-Tayyar each of those days. Now those days are gone, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. But this instruction, this encouragement, this recommendation still stands any day of the month of Rajab. This extra time that we have, learn of these prayers. Curse shaitan that keeps telling us, oh, don't do that. Start flipping through more Facebook, TikTok, this, that, the other. Oh, Allah, help me. Just get up 30 minutes. Salat Ja'far Tayyar. It's simple, honestly. The prayers that the Ahlul Bayt themselves do, we have a hadith that the Imam told the companion who was asking about Salat Ja'far Tayyar. This is for those who have already done it. Those who haven't done it, start with that. Do Salat Ja'far Tayyar. Those who've done it a number of times or have done it more frequently, will do the other. There's other prayers. The prayer of the Prophet, the prayer of Fatima al-Zahra, the prayer of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in. Read them. Read the instructions, how it's done, and perform it. We have this extra time. Usually we didn't have this time because we'd be busy with so many other things. Now we work from home, we study from home, school is from home, everything is from home. If we don't want to take advantage of this time, when are we going to do these great deeds that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us, these gems? Hopefully Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps us take advantage of the current conditions that we have and be involved and engaged in this reflection and connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, reflection over our deeds, picking out flaws, asking God to forgive, trying to change, inshallah, and hopefully by the end of it, we'll come out a better person, someone who has been able to overcome their bad habits, realize their mistakes in treating different people around them, and correct those ill behaviors towards others, inshallah. We hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with all of that.
رجب رجب هل علينا واقترب رجب رجب هل علينا واقترب يا مرحبا شهر رجب هل علينا واقترب شهر كريم وأصب فالرحمة فيه تصب شهر كريم وأصب فالرحمة فيه تصب الصوم فيه مستحب من صام يوما من رجب أعظم أجر قد كسب
رجب رجب
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
The occasion of International Mother Language Day, February the 21st, warrants a look at one of the most beautiful and important languages, Persian or Farsi. As this language attracts a lot of the wrong kind of attention as well as appreciation by some of the world's greatest poets, among them Goethe, the great German poet, who drew on Persian verse for his works. The wrong kind of attention, on the other hand, has historically come from ill-wishers trying to divide and rule this strategically located rich land, which connects the Indian subcontinent to Europe and is strategically placed on the Silk Routes. A latest attempt at mischief, however, has arisen closer to home under the guise of the hashtag ManoFarsi, or Me and Persian. What can be said of Persian? What has been said of it? Persian is sugar. Persian is the language of poetry and culture. It has been in India. And it's been the language of science. Most importantly here, it's a common Iranian language, unifying and uniting Iranian peoples. But now people outside are telling us to bin the language, or at best, lock it up. Sounds crazy, I know. But many a wise man has said much on the issue, as it's nothing new. So to hear some of what's said, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Hashtag ManoFarsi claims to highlight language discrimination in Iran.
Mohsen Rasuli, known as an anti-racism activist, said, "We want to raise awareness about the suffering of living in a monolingual system within a multilingual society." Sounds to me like the society is multilingual. So the many languages and dialects are alive, so they haven't been crushed, although Iran is a sovereign state and needs a state language, which it has. Mr. Rahimi, PhD, goes further in saying why Persian was no adversary to those local languages and dialects. He is on the scientific board of the Art and Literature Cultural Center. He says standard modern Persian has in fact borrowed from them in growing richer.
It's in the nature of the Farsi language and Farsi speakers throughout history that they don't consider the language a superior one. They don't consider a poem in another language as inferior or primitive compared to Farsi. That's what I mean when I say they're all part of a larger corpus. The more we focus on strengthening them, the main corpus gets stronger. It won't be weaker. Farsi isn't harmed if Kurdish poetry is strengthened.
If France and Germany need an official state language or lingua franca, so does Iran, a land united by a Persian king 2,500 years ago. And indeed, this lingua franca Persian has not destroyed its sister languages and dialects under its far-reaching shade. They have existed all along, but speakers of those languages have chosen Persian to recite poetry in, therefore making Persian their own. So why would they give it up together with their Iranian nationality and claim on the whole of Iran by separating from the mainland and adopting their own provincial language or dialect as their lingua franca in their new country, which would actually be no more than a province? Because that is the course of action suggested by the Man of Farsi hashtag and the like.
First of all, separation or division into united or federal states doesn't mean scrapping a common language facilitating relations. Look at America or Germany. Secondly, why divide a country now that the whole world is becoming one? Just because Saudi Arabia or Israel think it's a good idea?
Mr. Simyari is a media man who's delved into all controversial matters in detail. Leaving office and field work behind, he stepped into our studios to share his insight on today's issue.
It's interesting to know that, for example, in France, since 2018, all dialects other than the standard language are banned. Why aren't the enemies targeting that? Following Brexit, 17 British, 38 German and 2 Italian dialects were totally banned there. This shows that the issue of identity and a shared language is pretty significant. Farsi is the standard language here, but as you know, Kurdish and Turkish are being taught in our schools. The parents speak their local language to their children at home. We have never run into any problems in that regard. But the enemy invests energy on such issues because it wants to target our culture.
The said hashtag went round like hotcakes at the hands of Persian language UK-based news channels such as Iran International. That's a channel funded via a secret offshore entity and a company whose director is a businessman from Iran's regional rival, Saudi Arabia. And he has close links to the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Not to bash Saudi alone, Turkey has been working on its pan-Turkism aspirations. Israel has said the Middle East should be split down into small states, and the West won't forget the mantra Britain went by, divide and rule, that is, given their interest in Iran. Mr. Ghadiri Abiyane is a former ambassador who gives us his time now and again. He made a trek to Press TV studios to now talk on Farsi and the weight it is to bear, as well as the pleasure.
The colonist policy in dealing with Muslim nations and third world countries in general is that of divide and conquer. They've devised a whole slew of plans for that too. Take Africa, for example. Taking a look at the map of the continent, you'll see thousands of kilometers of straight border lines. That obviously hasn't been natural, they're hand-drawn. But somewhere along the borders, you will see the lines moved a little. What is that? It's where they've divided an ethnic community into two parts to turn that into a dispute for both countries. Or they may have left some parts of the borders open, so both sides have territorial claims on the land and are in constant opposition to each other. Or they may have sowed religious discord among the people, calling one group Shia and the other Sunni. They've even created divisions among Shia Muslims. This is while all those people believe in Islam. They've started ethnic disputes and fomented racist ideas.
Not to make a big thing of what sounds like what must have just been a teenage schoolgirl complex, but Sebel Soleimani, co-founder of the End of Monolingualism campaign, complained to Iran Wire about having been in a class of 35 non-Persian speakers in first grade in Iran. The complaint is, these 35 non-Persian speakers had to study in Persian. Well, if in Ardabil, where she spent her early life, of course the whole class will have learned their first few words at home in Azeri Turkish, as that is free to talk informally, is taught at school in Azerbaijan province alongside Farsi, and is broadcast in on local TV stations. Now, who wouldn't want their child to study in the state language at school? Apparently, Soleimani, whom I quote as saying, "The Iranian education system is not designed for language learning. The system is geared toward high literacy, assuming that all children know Persian. About 50% have no idea." Han, that's why they go to school, to learn. I might add, Soleimani, who had such trouble learning Persian or studying in Persian at school, put herself through learning English to mastery. As PhD student of sociology at George Mason University, Virginia, USA.
I realized something interesting when I examined the hashtag that became trending. At first, the hashtag was used only 8 times. But immediately after Al Arabiya Farsi and Saudi Arabia's Iran International carried out operational work on it, the hashtag was used and retweeted nearly 43,000 times on social media platforms. This showed that a party was taking initiative and driving a movement. It was very interesting. Our findings showed that the cyber movement was being directed from Saudi Arabia and the occupied territories that were being helped by separatists and counter-revolution groups. They were creating an atmosphere we know as psychological warfare, which is part of the hybrid warfare the leader of the Islamic Revolution mentioned in his latest remarks.
Now another tiny point. Soleimani grew up in Parsabad in Azerbaijan. Parsabad meaning a land constructed by Persians or inhabited by Persians. That's one example to show the area never started out as Azeri Turkish speaking to begin with. Azer or Azar actually means fire in Persian, indicating a Zoroastrian past rather than Turkish.
A person living in Samarkand cannot say that Farsi is an international language that can be used to communicate with someone in Tehran. That person has a share in the creation and possession of this language. That's the case for a person living in Tabriz. Qatran Tabrizi wrote poems in the city not too further in time than Rudaki. The land where Nizami Ganjavi was born has a share too. When we say we have a Farsi language that can rise in the world and have something to say among other languages, is because of these masterpieces.
As for statistics, apart from a Persian past, 53% of Iranians speak Persian as a main language. That's to say, over half of Iranians say their early words in Persian, in their mother tongue. The 2001 Iranian census put the figure of Iranians born to the Persian language at 68%. That figure included distinctive dialects such as Lori. Well, a dialect can be considered a branch of the main language. But never mind that. There's no telling any two given Lori or Kurdish villages will understand one another's dialect or language variation. So what now? Even if just for argument's sake enemies manage to divide Iran, the many dialects among each tribe and ethnicity will be a problem. They will still have to select one version of their mother tongue, say Kurdish, as their official language. And we'll be back to a tighter version of monolingualism with the exclusion of any language common between them. In other words, omitting Persian is just an excuse to weaken Iran at its core.
We belong to a historical identity that is above and beyond that of the American, Saudi, and the Israeli enemies. They know that they can't confront a nation that has such a strong cultural and civilizational background. But they can put cracks on its body and gradually make it spread. That is what they are investing in.
In keeping with divide-and-conquer policy, they're focusing on the linguistic division of the people. Why shouldn't every ethnic group speak its own language, Farsi? Why are they trying to teach English and French to every single person? Is it because they want Iranians to forget their own language and learn theirs instead? We don't take issue with learning a foreign language, but they keep insisting on pushing Farsi to the side.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Time for a quick diversion to hear from other media outlets of ancient evidence of Persian language and literature and its reach, as well as comments on its poets and their contributions. Here's how our sites of choice have put it in words. The Tehran Times reveals rock-carved inscription stairs discovered in southern Iranian plain. Cultural heritage personnel during their routine inspections have discovered a rock-carved inscription and some rock-hewn stairs in Marvdasht Plain. Situated in Fars province, the southern Iranian plain is home to the UNESCO-registered sites of Persepolis and Pasargad, as well as tens of other magnificent structures. The inscription, measuring 100 by 75 centimeters, bears Nastaliq scripts, which is the predominant style of Persian calligraphy during the 15th and 16th centuries. Persian language, also called Farsi, is a member of the Iranian branch of the Indo-Iranian language family. That's a part of Indo-European, actually. Old Persian, spoken until approximately the 3rd century BC, is attested to by numerous inscriptions written in cuneiform, most notable of which is the great monument of Darius I at Bisatun, western Iran. Newsweek quotes some praise of Ferdowsi while bringing news of entertainment. Bulgarian director Elena Panayotova praises Ferdowsi's efforts to maintain the Persian language. The Bulgarian stage director has praised the efforts made by Persian poet Ferdowsi over a millennium ago to protect the Persian language against foreign language threats. She came to Tehran to stage her latest production, Shahnameh, a story of Zal, based on a story from Ferdowsi's magnum opus, the Shahnameh, or Book of Kings, at the 40th Fajr International Theatre Festival. We know that the Shahnameh has produced abundant, attractive literature for humanity, she said in a press release published by the organizers of the 2022 Fajr Theatre Festival. I have studied about Ferdowsi's life, death, and his masterpiece, and gradually came to understand that it was his Shahnameh that managed to maintain the Persian language, and that the Persian language would have been ruined if the masterpiece had not been created, she noted. Greater Kashmir has something on preserving Persian heritage. Preserving Persian epigraphic heritage, it reads. With the establishment of the Muslim Sultanate in Kashmir in the late 14th century, the Sanskrit language and Sharda alphabet were also taken over by Persian and Arabic alphabets. The tradition of Sharda epigraphic culture also declined considerably and gave way to Persian and Arabic inscriptions. The earliest Persian and Arabic inscriptions are seen on tombstones and walls in the olden graveyards, khanqahs, and mosques of Kashmir. The number of such inscriptions are documented in a book titled Kashmir Inscriptions of Kashmir, which was published in the year 2013 by Gulshan Books, Srinagar. That'll be it for the news section, but do stay tuned for the rest of our narration. The said hashtag circulators and promoters say they want to see an acceptance of pluralism and of ethnic, linguistic, religious and gender diversity. Well, it looks like their hashtag would have each new provincial country teaching its own mother tongue or dialect as its lingua franca, leaving it truly monolingual without the treasure that is Persian. The hashtag promoters, however, do complain about monolingualism enforced in Iran, saying that even in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, under Article 15, the teaching of literature in one's mother tongue is explicitly emphasized. Mother tongue meaning their local language or dialect. I say, so what now? They're complaining about the Constitution calling for and enforcing what they do want? Two articles of Iran's Constitution cover the status of ethnic minorities. Chapter 2, Article 15 reads, "The official language and script of Iran, the lingua franca of its people, is Persian. Official documents, correspondence and texts, as well as textbooks, must be in this language and script. However, the use of regional and tribal languages in the press and mass media, as well as for teaching of their literature in schools, is allowed in addition to Persian."
Nobody demanded Ghatran to write Farsi poems. No one asked the poet in Shiraz to write in Farsi. They all chose to do that themselves. The Farsi that took shape 1100 years ago underwent an evolution throughout the centuries that passed. Which version of Farsi are we feeling proud of? The Farsi that Hafez, Nizami, and Rumi, who went from Balkh to Konya, wrote their poems in. That's the Farsi we're proud of and rely on. No government ordered Rumi to write poems in Farsi. This is a rug, each knot of which belongs to a specific region. The more knots there are in the rug, the more durable it will be.
Chapter 3, Article 19 says, "All people of Iran, whatever the ethnic group or tribe to which they belong, enjoy equal rights, and color, race, language, and the like do not bestow any privilege."
I'm from Gilan. I was born to a Talishi family and my mother tongue is Talishi. My family migrated to Rasht and started speaking to me in Gilaki when I was born. I acquired Gilaki at home, learned Farsi at school and learned to speak Talishi at the same time. What sparked my interest in the Farsi language, which I've studied as a major and I'm speaking right now, was the fascination I had in Shahriyar's poetry back in my student years. If I didn't know Shahriyar, maybe I would have pursued a different educational and occupational path.
Talking of the unifying element of Persian, this language that has given Iranians a wealth of literature and science to boast, and which all touched by it love it and won't give it up, Dariush Shayegan, an Iranian scholar, puzzled when in Egypt as to why Egyptians, themselves an ancient civilization, would take on Arabic as their state language. Hassanein Heykal, an Egyptian journalist, explained, "Because we didn't have a Ferdowsi," meaning we didn't have a poet that great to write a divan using a minimum of Arabic and a maximum of our own words to rescue and preserve our language and mythology. Because that is what the great Ferdowsi did for Iran and Iranians of any creed and color.
The BBC Persian made a program and invited someone for an interview as a linguistic expert. The first question the host asked the expert was, "What sufferings have you had to experience throughout the years because of Farsi?" "We have had over 200,000 Farsi dialects in the country. The people have lived with each other for centuries and have never had a problem with their languages." The question the BBC Persian host posed and the answer the expert gave laid the foundation for the other issues. After that, Al Arabiya Farsi, which is a part of Saudi Arabia's security agencies, asked the viewers, "What problems do you have with Farsi?" It is interesting to know that the BBC Persian expert is an agent managed and controlled by Germany's Federal Intelligence Service. His ties with Western intelligence services in Europe and the cooperation between them and Saudi and Arab services to affect the people in our society are the manifestation of the hybrid warfare we are currently witnessing.
See, the Azeris, that's people from eastern and western Azerbaijan provinces, call Tehran Central Azerbaijan. I need not explain their prominent presence in the capital. Here are some examples of ethnicities, all ethnicities, if you can call all of them ethnicities, who have been of position in the state's power parities.
I think they were gauging the public reaction. It's the nature of media work. You're doing this yourself. We have a day called the International Mother Language Day and create appropriate events to mark it. It falls on the 2nd of Isfand or the 21st of February. The fact that they focused on the issue 3 to 4 weeks prior to the day in their media can signal that they were after bigger plans and were just testing the waters. The results they saw wasn't what they expected. The educated people living in Azerbaijan, even those who write poems in their local language, those in Gilan and others, didn't give them the results they wanted. What the Iranians told them was kind of a slap in their face. I believe that they canceled their other plans because of that.
The first evidence of Persian literature is generally dated to 522 BCE with the creation of the Behistun inscription of Darius I. New or modern Persian, however, the form written since the 9th century, is known as Farsi in Iran, where it is the country's official language, and as Dari in Afghanistan, where it and Pashto are official languages. It is written in a Cyrillic alphabet by Tajiks in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. New Persian, that's the Persian we've been speaking about, has for centuries been a prestigious cultural language in Western Central Asia, on the Indian subcontinent, and in Turkey.
What all Europeans stand for is to remove the barriers and have single identity cards and means of communication so they can invest anywhere in Europe and become more united. They want Iran to be divided, and yet they themselves move towards unity. But you can already invest anywhere in Iran and live anywhere across the country. We have it all in here. Now imagine Iran has been divided into five separate regions. What we want is to have them united the way Europe is trying to. They wanted to establish a common language, but failed. Over there in Europe, every country, be it Germany, France, Italy, or Norway, has its own language. But over here, our common language is Farsi, but all other languages are of equal value.
In the past, Persian was widely understood in an area ranging from the Middle East or West Asia to Central and South Asia, even to Xinjiang in China. Persian is the second language of Islam. It was instrumental in spreading the faith during the reign of the Mughals in the Indian subcontinent. There are many Persian words to be found in Urdu and Turkish, and the study of Ottoman Turkish literature actually would be meaningless without knowledge of Persian. Never mind the Persian language, the Turks are pretty cut off from their past because they changed their script. There are sizable Persian language or dialect-speaking populations in other West Asian countries as well, such as Bahrain, Iraq, Oman, Yemen, and the UAE. Large communities in Europe, Turkey, Australia, the USA, and Canada also speak standard Persian.
I think you can find the most beautiful words in Farsi in the poems of Ferdowsi, Hafez, and Saadi. Our language has been so rich that you can see its impressions on the works of Goethe and Western writers. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons the British focused on Farsi and launched such psychological warfare was because of the same reasons. They wanted to toot the English language and culture as superior. But if they have Shakespeare, we have Hafez, Saadi, and Rumi. We have a cultural and civilizational hub, something they are against.
That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Voleurs. seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim عليه السلام. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam Musa al-Kazim was the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim was the son of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, when we talk about Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam, we see historically that he left an amazing legacy full of goodness, righteousness, beauty, and he was a brilliant guide for the community in general. And among the unique aspects that marked Imam al-Kazim's personality is his steadfastness and determination, his perseverance in front of the difficult events and the ordeals showered upon him by his contemporary tyrants. Old and young have an amazing opportunity to learn to how to deal with life's difficulties by looking into the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن العاقل لا يحدث من يخاف تكذيبه ولا يسأل من يخاف منعه ولا يعد ما لا يقدر عليه ولا يرجو ما يعنف برجائه ولا يتقدم على ما يخاف العجز عنه.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "Verily, the man of intellect never talks to one whom he fears will belie him, nor asks of one whom he fears will deny him, nor promises that which he is not able to fulfill, nor hopes for that which will dash his hopes, nor attempts to advance towards that which he fears he will be incapable of reaching."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, in the various conversations that we have from the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find a very interesting conversation where Imam al-Kazim advises his companions and his followers in a certain thing. Now, this certain thing that Imam al-Kazim advises his companions and his followers is to refrain from the things that have made forbidden by Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. Meaning, he tells his companions in this conversation that they must refrain from that which is haram, that which is forbidden by Allah. And so the definition of piety or taqwa is a very vast definition. It ranges from God consciousness, being aware of God at all times. This is taqwa. And at other hands, it has also been referred to as refraining from committing haram, from things that are forbidden by Allah. It is in the second context here that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam speaks to us about refraining from things that are haram and forbidden by Allah, as well as taqwa and piety. And so Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, referring to his father Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, says, "He about whose piety and taqwa the women even kept in seclusion do not talk about does not belong to our followers." Now, it's kind of a complicated thing. When you hear it the first time, it might not make sense, but let's talk about it a little bit. So first of all, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam here is talking about taqwa. He's talking about piety. He's talking about this being aware of Allah at all times. He's talking about refraining and not committing things that are haram. Now, what should this level of taqwa be? To what extent should we be refraining from committing things that are haram? Well, he says, to the extent that women who are in seclusion, they are even aware of the fact that a certain individual is so pious. So, for example, let's take Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Ali alayhi salam's piety and taqwa in all its different meanings was to such an extent that people far and wide knew about his taqwa. And likewise, women who are kept in seclusion, even they knew about the taqwa of Imam Ali. And so our piety, our taqwa, our fear and reverential fear of Allah, and our refraining from committing evil deeds and haram, and our being aware of the Almighty Allah, should be to this great extent if we want to have the honor of being called the followers of the infallible imams. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And so this issue of being al-kadhimin al-ghayz, to restrain the anger, this is such an important issue that the famous title of the Imam, seventh Imam, has become al-kadhim. And I would just like to slightly digress with inspiration from this title of the seventh Imam, al-kadhim. Because the essential message that we have is that we have to control our emotions. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created two kinds of emotions within us. And these emotions and feelings that we have, these are important. These are not to be totally suppressed. But we have to control it and express that, or, you know, give into the emotions within the bounds of the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, when we look at the issue of anger, al-kadhim al-ghayz, somebody who controls the anger. From the perspective of Islamic ethics, the balanced personality is of a person who balances, you know, this issue of the emotions that we have. You don't have to be always angry. Otherwise, you'll become a very unhealthy person within yourself. But you don't have to suppress your anger totally. You should know where you have to be angry, and you should know where you have to restrain your anger. When you become angry, it should be to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When you restrain your anger, that also should be for the sake of pleasing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then you come to that balance. Otherwise, if somebody is just angry all the time, well, then he is a slave of his emotions. And if somebody suppresses the anger, even when he is supposed to be angry, then that is the sign of a person who is coward. So you have to have that balance in between, that you have to see the time and place where you have to, you know, express your emotions, and the time and place where you have to control your emotions. Al-Kadhim al-Ghayz deals with the issue of suppressing the anger.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the first glimpse of a Partygate questionnaire confirms that Downing Street insiders are being questioned under police caution and asked if they have a reasonable excuse for attending lockdown-busting gatherings. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Heather Stewart. The piece is titled "Leak Confirms Partygate Questionnaire Includes Police Caution." The first glimpse of a Partygate questionnaire confirms that Downing Street insiders are being questioned under police caution and asked if they have a reasonable excuse for attending lockdown-busting parties. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already returned his replies to the Metropolitan Police's questions and is believed to have argued that he attended social events at No. 10 Downing Street in a work capacity. A copy of one of the official questionnaires obtained by ITV shows it includes the police caution, "You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something which you subsequently rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence." Angela Rayner, Labour's deputy leader, said, "This is an embarrassment that for the first time in United Kingdom history, we have a Prime Minister interviewed under police caution." As well as asking the recipients to confirm their attendance at a specific event, the leaked questionnaire shows they were also asked, "What was the purpose of your participation in that gathering? And did you interact with or undertake any activity with other persons present at the gathering? If yes, please provide details." Recipients of the questionnaire were offered the opportunity to give a lawful exception or reasonable excuse for attending. Boris Johnson is understood to have hired a lawyer to help him draw up his responses, which Downing Street has confirmed were submitted before the deadline of last Friday. Questionnaires are still being sent to some officials. The Metropolitan Police will then have to decide whether to impose fixed penalty notices for breaking lockdown rules. The Metropolitan Police investigation into 12 social events, several of which the Prime Minister is known to have attended, was triggered by evidence uncovered by the senior civil servant Sue Gray, whose full report on her inquiry will not be published until the police have completed their work. Boris Johnson's allies are convinced he has a justification for attending events that took place at No. 10, which is his home as well as his workplace. He initially denied reports that parties had been held in Downing Street, telling MPs all guidance was followed completely. Receiving a fixed penalty notice for breaching rules that he himself drew up is regarded as unacceptable to many Conservative backbenchers and would be likely to prompt more letters calling for a vote of no confidence. If 54 such letters are submitted to the chair of the 1922 committee, Graham Brady, a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson would be triggered, and if he lost such a vote, his premiership would be effectively over. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has repeatedly refused to say whether he would resign if fined by the police for breaking COVID laws at a series of alleged Downing Street parties.